This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Happy New Year, DSR listeners. This year, we're adding even more content and benefits for members, including a new weekly column written by David Rothkopf, more exclusive content, new shows and hosts, and soon, a new membership option that will include a mix of live and virtual events and interactive discussions. Members also receive an ad-free listening experience, members-only bonus content, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, a members-only newsletter, and members-only blog posts. Membership is just $5 per month or $50 per year. To become a member, visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you and Happy New Year.
Nine, 12, 10, 28. 2:23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the podcast. I'm your host, David Rothkopf, coming to you from cold but lovely Washington, D.C. We are joined today also in Washington, D.C. by our dear friends, Corey Shockey of the American Enterprise Institute. How are you doing today, Corey?
I'm exceedingly well. Thank you, David.
Excellent. And Rosa Brooks in Alexandria, Virginia of Georgetown University Law School. How are you doing today, Rosa Brooks?
I'm well. Thank you, David.
And far away for those of us who are in Washington, but close to everyone else in Israel, we have Alon Pincus, former senior Israeli diplomat in multiple posts and also a regular columnist for Haaretz. How are you doing this evening, Alon?
Very well, thank you, all things considered, but I don't want to start kvetching, so I'm good.
You are here to kvetch. In fact, you're the official kvetcher of Deep State Radio. You wrote a interesting column summing up the visit of Secretary of State Antony Blinken to Israel. For those who have not seen it, who maybe do not follow you as they should on a regular basis in Haaretz, what was your point?
Well, the point was that there were two points to begin with. The first one was that the Secretary of State, I doubt that the Secretary of State wanted to be where he was. A month into the formation of the government, with the U.S.'s short and medium-term interests lying in the Ukraine-Russia war and long-term foreign policy challenges and commitments in China, the last thing the administration wanted was to be dragged into the Middle East. On top of which, if you had asked President Biden or Secretary Blinken or DCIA Bill Burns, who was there just the day before, or National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, who was there 3 days before, who was here, I'm sorry, 3 days before, they would want nothing more than Israel to disappear from the front pages of the Washington Post and New York Times, and certainly to disappear from the top page or top screen of the presidential's daily briefing. Yet the Middle East has a tendency, and Israel has a proclivity to superimpose itself on the American agenda. And so Blinken came here. So the first point was he didn't. My first point is he'd rather not be here. Or as W.C. Fields says on his tombstone, I'd rather be in Philadelphia. The second point
Hey, that's Philadelphia you're dissing.
I know.
As we should. As any New York Giants fan should. It was such an outrage this week that the Empire State Building was lit in the colors of the Philadelphia Eagles.
But it was fabulous to see the responses to it, including from a Twitter handle called New York's Other Buildings.
I saw that. I actually saw that. I thought it was disgusting. And I followed the Empire State Building account on Twitter, and I told them, shame on you. Not bad enough that you put it green when it's the Jets, but now the Eagles. But the second point was, apropos the Blinken visit, was that he came here at a time when there is a convergence at a certain point on the timeline of an assault on democracy within Israel, a domestic onslaught on the political and constitutional, on the Supreme Court, and indeed on the notion and concept of separation of powers, and a conflagration in the territories between Israel and the Palestinians, and bellicose statements and actions coming out of Israel vis-a-vis Iran. And that was probably the reason Blinken came here. All in all, I thought it was a good visit, as these visits are, but...
Corey, one of the things that Alon said in his column was that Blinken was essentially mild but direct in expressing the concerns of the United States. What did you think of his tone? And if either you or Rosa obviously have any questions for Alon in Israel, feel free to direct them in that direction also.
You know, I think American diplomacy is generally well served by mild and direct conversations with close friends. And we were reminded of it in a European context the last couple of weeks with the drama over Germany providing Leopard tanks to Ukraine. So in general, I think that's the right tone. I also think the delicacy...
Just to tease that out a little bit, just as a subset, it's kind of off the point, but Lloyd Austin went to this contact group meeting in Ramstein, and he's always sort of behind the scenes and quiet, and yet he got done what he wanted to get done. That does seem to me an example of mild and direct that work, right?
I think that's right. It matters that the Secretary of Defense gathers 50 of his counterparts every single month to hear from Ukrainians what they need and to figure out how to get it to them. I have the sense, though, that in this particular example, the administration was surprised that Germany wouldn't consent without the U.S. providing tanks that aren't a terrific fit for Ukraine's needs. But it's a reminder, which takes us back to the Middle East, about how much it matters to America's allies when they feel threatened to have American skin in the game. And my sense of what's going on in administration policy toward Israel, you know, the big military exercise we just did together, is that there are turning the kaleidoscope, trying to find effective levers to affect the Iranian government's judgment about returning to the JCPOA. And I, of course, defer to Alon and think he's right about Blinken not wanting to be there, especially now, given all that's going on internal to Israel and between Israel and the Palestinians. But I think a lot of the activism is actually driven by a desire to find some way to show support to America's friends in the region as Iran continues to not take seriously JCPOA negotiations.
So, Alon, jot down Iran, because we'll come back to it. But I want to hear Rosa's comment to the opening bit as well. So what do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, clearly, Tony Blinken would rather have been almost anywhere, even Philadelphia, than in Israel, standing next to Netanyahu. And, you know, Tony Blinken, like most diplomats, but perhaps even more so, he is a soft-spoken, careful guy. But when Tony Blinken says things like, you know, we need to make sure that we stand together because our shared interests and values, including core democratic principles, respect for human rights, the equal administration of justice for all, the equal rights of minority groups, a robust civil society, and so on. I mean, that coming from anybody else would be kind of anodyne cliches. Coming from Tony Blinken at that moment, in that place, in that tone, was sort of the diplomatic equivalent of, you better do this or else. I mean, it was a pretty stern warning. And I think it was understood that way by the Israeli press and within Israel, that that was not just a jolly, friendly, you know, we love you, we love you, that that was a, hey, if you can't live up to these values, there's going to be a serious problem. And, you know, he's right to push on that, obviously. But it's a difficult and uncomfortable moment. It's a moment where it seems like the potential, I mean, I'd be very interested in Alan, hearing your thoughts on this. It seems like this is a moment where things could go south really, really fast, potentially. And I'm curious to know whether you think Tony Blinken's remarks are likely to have the effect of sort of keeping things stable, or will they just make things worse and convince the hardliners within Israel that there's no point, you know, the U.S. is going to be mad at them anyway, so they might as well just do whatever they want to do.
Well, he's not going to convince the right wing, certainly not the extreme right wing. And this government is made of three components, a hard right wing, an extreme right wing, and an ultra-Orthodox right wing. And I fail to see him convincing anyone that they should change course and alter the course, certainly not as a result of external pressure. Rosa, you listed the things that Blinken himself listed as core values. He was very, very precise in the things that he mentioned. He was enumerating not core values in the political science 101 class at Georgetown, but he was referring very directly and very unequivocally to the things that are laser pinpoint under assault in Israel right now. And he went on to laud the Israeli civil society and civic organizations for standing up and protesting and demonstrating. And these are the core values. And immediately, as you would have imagined, you had a right-wing response that first became, you know, the knee-jerk reaction, who is he to tell us what to do? Okay, put that aside. But then came the, what about this hypocrisy? I mean, why did we not hear an American Secretary of State saying these things about Hungary and Turkey to NATO members, not to mention our beloved friends and brothers, the Saudis? And the answer to that is, he also doesn't need to mention these things when he concludes a visit in Paris, London, Ottawa, or Amsterdam, or The Hague, because Israel wants to belong to the second group, not the first group, which is why he said what he said. And when a relationship is predicated on less in the last decade or so, less strategic commonality of interests and more the concept of shared values, it's perfectly okay for the U.S. to express its discomfort, displeasure, concern, call it what you want, with what's going on in Israel's backsliding into an illiberal, potentially backsliding into an illiberal democracy. Now, as for the Palestinians, he did one thing. David mentioned my column, and I thank him for it. But he did do one thing that I neglected to mention because it happened in the column, because it only came to light the day after. He left a team here, and he announced it after his visit to the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah yesterday, that he's leaving a team to overlook the renewal of security coordination and cooperation between Israel and the Palestinians. Now, I think that is a paramount interest the U.S. now has. And parenthetically, at the same time that Blinken was in Israel, King Abdullah was in Washington. By the way, Rosa, King Abdullah was a student of mine at Georgetown when I was a teaching assistant to Madeleine Albright in 1987. But that's,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I gave him an A. You know, for future references, I didn't want to
just in case you need the little leverage case, at some point. It's case, too yeah, bad no, you actually gave him a grade. You should have said, I'm going to wait and give you a grade in about 50 years.
No one thought at the time that he would become king. I mean, it was all about Hassan, King Hussein's younger brother, but then things, you know, happened the way, transpired the way they did. Okay, but that was just a biographical note that I'm sort of proud of. But at the same time that Blinken was here, King Abdullah was in Washington briefing members of Congress, and I can only imagine that he basically said to them what Blinken said here to Netanyahu, to Prime Minister Netanyahu, and that is, be careful, because if there is an implosion in the Palestinian Authority, you'll be looking at a completely different reality in which the U.S., and he did not say this publicly, which is why I emphasize that he was very mild and mellow and soft-spoken, but it was unequivocally clear that he said what he said that was, you know, kind of the subtext. If this goes on, both domestically in Israel, but even more so with the Palestinians, the U.S. is going to find it increasingly difficult to defend Israel and stand by Israel in places like the U.N. Security Council or the International Court of Justice or International Criminal Court, both in The Hague and elsewhere. So I think in that respect, that was a visit that was a cautionary tale of sorts. One more remark to all three of you who follow this U.S.-Israel relationship for years. Usually when these meetings end, and I'm not saying it's the same sequence, it's not always that the Secretary of State comes here, but it did happen when Hillary Clinton came in 2009 and then John Kerry came in 2012 after the U.S. election, in both cases in 8 and in 12. But this time, Blinken did not leave the proverbial invitation to the White House. Usually when a Secretary of State comes to Israel, he leaves a sort of an open-ended or sometimes even a direct invitation from the president. The president would love to see you in the very near future. And Israeli prime ministers are then very quick to boast domestically, well, I'll talk to Mr. Biden or Mr. Trump or Mr. Obama or Mr. Bush, go back as many presidents as you wish. This time it didn't happen. And I'm not saying, I'm not making too much of it, but it does, how should I say, veer away from the usual sequence of relations.
What do you think, Corey?
That's really interesting. And I doubt it's coincidence that it happened. I do think the administration's really struggling, and it's actually Prime Minister Netanyahu's own fault because he so stridently politicized the issue of Israel during the Trump administration.
And he did that deliberately, Corey.
Yeah. And even under cooperative circumstances, that's going to take a while to wear off. And I'm not surprised that the administration doesn't think it's clear that we're in cooperative circumstances with the Israeli government.
Now, can I add one more thing, David?
Sure, but then Rosa will have to respond to it.
No, well, absolutely. You know, this is a
board. What if I just agree?
The Borscht Belt political culture. No, my only addition to what Corey just said is that in order to somehow correct the media reports, or in his mind, to correct the record of the media reports of Blinken's visit, Netanyahu last night hurried to grant an interview to Jake Tapper from CNN, in which, according to an article published by our mutual friend Amir Tibon today, and listed in a lengthy Twitter thread by former U.S. ambassador to Israel Martin Indyk, he just lied between 6 and 10 times, depends how you treat each and every lie. And Netanyahu was trying hard to relay a message that through his CNN interview was clear, or put the spotlight on what Blinken was doing here. Netanyahu was very adamant in insisting that he calls the shots, he's in control, he will set policy, he will set the tone, he will frame and define the entire political landscape. It was important for him to emphasize that, but along the way, he did what he does, what he usually does, and that is, unfortunately, misinform. I don't want to say lie, misinform.
You know, Rosa, a moment or two ago, Alon used the term, you know, backsliding with regard to Israel. You know, and I think one of the messages that Blinken sent was, don't become Viktor Orban. But he's already become Viktor Orban.
Yes, well, that was part of diplomatic politeness. That's right, pretending it hasn't happened already.
I mean, compared to where they were, they've been backsliding throughout the Trump administration.
It's quite shocking and it's quite distressing. And I actually have a question for Alon. One of the things that clearly is happening in the United States is a sort of generational realignment within both the Democratic Party, broadly speaking, and within American Jewish community, that although support for Israel remains and, you know, positive images of Israel remain quite strong in an older generation, that people, you know, under 40 or 50 more have a negative impression of Israel than positive. And we're seeing that reflected in Congress. We're seeing that reflected in public remarks by, you know, leading and very moderate Democrats in the Senate and the House, as well as by the left wing of the Democratic Party. And, you know, so it's clear that that shift is, there's a real realignment that that younger Jewish people in the United States and younger Democrats are really beginning to think of Israel as a lost cause in a way, you know, that they that Netanyahu has already become Viktor Orban, that things are not going to get better, that things are not going to change, that Israel should not be our friend, you know, that that of course the, you know, survival of the Jewish state people support, but the Israeli government, people are beginning to kind of give up on it. And I wonder if you think that, A, does Netanyahu care? Does his coalition government care? And do Israelis care? Or is this increasingly something where they're willing to also just shrug and say, you know what? We don't care what you think anymore. We don't really need you. It is not important to us any longer to maintain the support of the American Jewish community. We're fine.
Judging by Netanyahu's policies, actions, statements, and patterns of behavior, he's done this deliberately. And you see the evolution of this, Rosa, from the Clinton days. If you recall, 1998, first he aligned himself with Newt Gingrich, but then found out that Clinton won re-election. And so he had this spat, Clinton, that culminated in 98 when he came to Washington and, before seeing the president, went at the Mayflower Hotel to a big gathering of Jerry Falwell's evangelical organization. Was it the Moral Majority? And you see it ever since, his relations with Obama and his bromance with Trump. He has made a conscious decision. First, he looked at the numbers. He said, all right, there are 6.5 million American Jews, 5.5, depends how you count, 75% of which vote for Democrats. They're all, you know, Upper West Side New York liberals who don't get it. So I'll replace. This is his version of replacement theory. I'll replace the 6.5 million, the 6 million, with 75 million evangelicals who love me. And, you know, the rupture and Armageddon and crime rate is going up in Washington, I hear. And rupture and Armageddon and all that, you know, that could wait. And he aligned himself first with Gingrich, then with the Tea Party, and then with the Trump MAGA, Make America Great Again, used to be by name only Republicans. It was okay when he was tilting trending Republican. That's fine. But he aligned himself clearly with the most right-wing elements of the Republican Party. And he couldn't care less about American Jews because they don't get it. Now, on top of that, you have to give him credit for one thing. He was looking at the same data that we know, that not only 75% on average of American Jews vote for Democrats, but when asked by J Street, Pew Research, or the American Jewish Committee, three organizations of which conducted polls, not at the same time, but throughout the last decade, Israel is not the top five and rarely in the top 10 issues when a Jewish person comes to vote, whether he lives in New York, Chicago, Miami, or San Francisco, or Washington. And so Netanyahu doesn't care about American Jews. You know, if you take another aspect of this, he's the first one to keep on using the term the progressives, the radical left in America, the squad, as you know, insinuating or dog whistling that this is basically anti-Semitism. The Berkeley campus and Ilhan Omar and AOC are basically anti-Semites, while John Hagee is a true friend of Israel. Forget what John Hagee said about Jews and former Prime Minister Sharon. That's conveniently forgotten. So I don't think he cares. To make a long story short and a short question to avoid a too lengthy answer, I don't think he cares. But where will he care? If there is an open confrontation, Blinken did make it clear, again, in his visit in the Palestinian Authority rather than inside Israel, that the U.S. opposes expansion of settlements, opposes annexation of any Palestinian areas, including so-called Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank, but only a small number of Palestinians reside in. If Blinken is against that, and Blinken being the U.S., so if the U.S. is opposed to that, that is also opposed to the very basic guidelines of this government that writes and states clearly that it intends to expand settlements and annex territories. And that puts Israel and the U.S. on a almost inalterable collision course.
Corey.
So, Alon, can I ask, how do the limits on cooperation with Abraham Accord countries come into this equation about the Netanyahu government's policies? Are they likely to be able to be a restraining force on settlements or Palestinian issues?
Well, the short answer is yes, they should be, because Netanyahu is quietly saying to everyone who cares to hear that his number one foreign policy priority is going to be relations or expanding or formalizing relations with the Saudis. That's not going to be achieved if he does nothing with the Palestinians. If you look at the composition of a coalition, he's not going to do anything with the Palestinians. If Minister of no less National Security, Ben-Gvir, is going to go up, ascend to Temple Mount again, that's going to cause a big deal with Jordan and the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. So it on the face of it, it should limit and constrain and restrain him, but I just don't see that happening. He's not really in charge. He's being held hostage by the extreme right wing, who know he is weak because his prime objective is to extricate himself from a criminal trial that is going on against him on charges of bribery, corruption, fraud, and obstruction of justice. And they're holding him, and he's beholden to them.
Earlier, Corey mentioned that one of the potential bridges in the relationship has to do with Iran policy. Let me first go to Rosa, but then to Alon, and then maybe Corey may have some final thoughts on this. Do you see that as a possible area where these two administrations can work together, Rosa, or are there even substantial enough differences there?
I mean, I defer to Alon on this, but it seems to me that there is a very narrow area of overlap of interest. I mean, obviously, we don't want Iran supplying drones to Russia. We don't want Iran to continue to develop its nuclear program. Neither does Israel on that. Certainly on that second one, I'm not sure Israel cares all that much on the first. But Israel has consistently taken a much more hardline stand on Iran than Obama's administration or the Biden administration has taken in terms of a sort of willingness to try to talk things through, willingness to initially, give the JCPOA or JCPOA, as we like to call it here on Deep State Radio, a chance to try to revive any pieces of that. I don't get any sense that the Israeli government has the slightest interest in seeing us do that or helping us do that. On the contrary, and I don't know Israeli attack on an Iran drone making facility. I have no idea whether that is something that the U.S. was aware of beforehand or whether the U.S. found out about it after the fact. But generally speaking, the U.S. has been, at best ambivalent and frequently distressed by Israeli direct action inside Iran, which is seen as potentially destabilizing to diplomatic efforts that the U.S. is interested in undertaking. So obviously, both countries are, from where I sit, it looks as though obviously both countries are very concerned about Iran, but what they each see as the potential path forward for diplomacy is quite different from the Israeli side, essentially none. And I don't know, Alon, what is your take on that? Does that seem right, or am I missing some of the nuances?
No. I think you're absolutely right. Okay. You know, if we dissect this, we're going to see some different tiers or layers of policy. First, there's the nuclear issue, and then there's the non-nuclear pattern of Iranian activity in the Middle East. Per the nuclear issue, on the face of it, the U.S. and Israel say the same thing. We will not allow Iran to develop a military nuclear option. Biden had said this repeatedly, and I believe him. Trump said it for whatever that matters, and Obama said that, which ergo the JCPOA, or JACPO, as you call it in D.C., in 2015. But there is a major difference that needs to be emphasized here. The U.S. is tolerant, is okay, and can live with a threshold state, Iran. Threshold being a spectrum in which Iran gradually, but very, very slowly, moving towards the ability to manufacture, produce, develop a nuclear option, but not making a political decision not to go, or breakout time, so to speak, not to go there. Israel says, ostensibly, and this is successive Israeli governments, not this particular government, that it cannot live with a threshold Iran. So there's a gap here that everyone's trying to paint over, but at some point it's going to be out. The second thing, the second tier, the second level of analysis is the nuclear versus the non-nuclear. When in 2015 there was criticism of Obama and indeed the U.S.'s decision to go on the JCPOA, the main criticism was, yeah, but it doesn't do anything about Iran's missile development, drone development, mentoring of terror organization, and network of proxy organization that is destabilizing the Middle East. And Obama said, as did others, guys, you said that the existential threat is the nuclear issue. We took care of that. Had we tried to include the other things, we wouldn't have an agreement. By that, we mean, as far as the other issues are concerned, you're free to operate. Just don't escalate this too much and don't drag us in. Israel took this as a yellow light, not a green light, but a yellow light to operate against Iran, which it did effectively or not remains to be seen. Attacking a drone plant reportedly in Isfahan, attacking a convoy of trucks in Syria, or attacking Iranian presence in the south of south of Syria on the Golan border, the Israel-Syria border, falls under the category of non-nuclear. That's fine, but the U.S. is saying, guys, if you overdo this, if you open a new front, that will by definition drag us in, because by extension it drags the UAE and Bahrain and Oman and Saudi Arabia into this. And Israel should really stop bragging about this, goes the American argument. Israel should really stop bragging about this and not come out with statements like they did 2 days ago. It's always from a senior security official, never name, never face. It's always a senior guy who's saying, the Americans in Israel are on the same page. We're seeing things eye to eye. We're coordinated on both an intelligence and a policy level. That's not something the Americans want Israel to say. So even on that issue, I could see minor friction with the U.S. But, and this is my last insight on this, what the U.S. is most concerned about, I think, I don't know this for a fact, I'm guesstimating here, is that their experience with Benjamin Netanyahu is not good. Their experience with Benjamin Netanyahu's credibility and discretion is not good. When things that need to be coordinated, even disagreements that need to find some common ground, that should be held privately, discreetly, secretly, if you will, between head of Mossad and deputy and director of the CIA, between chief of staff and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, between defense minister and secretary of defense, between the prime minister and the president. If this comes out every Monday or Thursday as some Israeli bragging headline, that's not something the Americans want, particularly, and I go back to the beginning of our conversation, but particularly at a time when the U.S. is dealing with the Russia-Ukraine issue and trying to build slash manage alliances in the Indo-Pacific. That's the last thing the Americans want now.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Corey. Thank you, Rosa. Thanks to everybody for spending this time. We'll obviously track these issues on an ongoing basis. Keep following us at thedsrnetwork.com. And if you wish to become a member, there's a little button you can click there. Become a member for $5 a month. Help support more conversations like this. We'll see all you guys soon. Bye-bye.